Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 57. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're going retro once more with a movie from the 1960s and a movie from the 1970s. The one from the 1960s is the Ib Melchior movie, which people may know from many, many late night viewings on television. That is The Time Travelers, starring Preston Foster and Philip Carey. And then we zip pan to 1973 for the kind of not too successful adaptation of a Michael Moorcock novel, the only movie that's ever been made from a Michael Moorcock novel, and that is The Final Program, starring none other than John Finch, Jenny Runica, Sterling Hayden, Harry Andrews, Hugh Griffith, Julie Edge, Patrick McGee, Graham Crowden, George Kalouris, Basil Henson, and Derek O'Connor. So get out your needle guns and wait for that one. So, but I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then we'll start talking about time travel and the end of the world. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hello, what's happening, people? It's going pretty good here. It's going particularly good here because today is the day they released the teaser trailer for the next James Bond film, Spectre. And it was full of squee for me, and having been a James Bond fan since the 1960s, I'm just going wow at this one. And it's got a couple of really nice bits in it, including this.
You're a kite dancing in a hurricane, Mr. Bond.
And the first time we hear the voice of Ernst Stavro Blofeld since the 1980s in this.
Welcome, James. It's been a long time. And finally, here we are.
What can I say? I am there. I am going to see this movie. I'm going to see the shit out of this movie. And before anybody pretends that Christoph Waltz is not playing Ernst Stavro Blofeld, you're wrong. That's all I've got to say is you're wrong. And not only are you wrong on the internet, which makes it worse. But anyway, yeah, so things have been going okay here. The weather is turning autumnal, and that means that I'm drinking soup instead of eating salads and barbecuing for lunch. And it's going to be a cold winter in Australia. I've got a feeling that it's going to be a chilly one. So I'm going to rug up, and I'm going to watch a lot of movies, and I'm going to talk about them on the podcast. But first, of course, I've got to do the usual thing, mention the Patreon campaign. Thank you to Mark Leeper for being our latest Patreon subscriber. He's contributing to the upkeep of the podcast, and I really appreciate that. I'm looking later in the year, and this, again, is another one of my plans, which may never come to fruition, but it may do. I'm looking at doing some sponsor-only stuff for the podcast. Now, I'm not going to say what it is, and it won't be like a regular thing, but I want to give a bit of value added for the people who actually cough up the spondulics and contribute to the podcast. So I'm looking at doing something along those lines a little bit later in the year when the days are shorter. And it should be fun. It'll take us in a different direction, I hope. But anyway, on to the important stuff, which is, of course, is movies. And the movies that I have been running in front of my eyeballs since last we spoke. I'm just cranking up the Letterboxd now. If you go to Letterboxd without the E in the ED.com/paleocinema, you can see the movies that I've been watching since last time I had a chat. And by the way, thanks again to Paul White, who has been updating the Letterboxd lists on the movies covered by Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In Podcast. I really appreciate that, Paul, and thank you for the careful and assiduous work that you've been doing. So since the last time I had a podcast, I've been trying out a couple of streaming services. Streaming services are starting to come into Australia because our ropey internet is just getting to the stage where it's worth doing. And so I've checked out a couple of them so far, being Presto, which is the one that Foxtel owns, and Netflix, which opened this week in Australia. So I've got a free trial on both of them. So to be honest with you, Presto's shit. Netflix is better, but Netflix doesn't have a wide range of movies here in Australia yet. They have said, and their CEO has said, that he's going to increase the amount of movies and TV available in Australia via that platform. Now, the reason I say the Presto is shit and Netflix isn't, Netflix does HD, Presto doesn't. And Presto keeps buffering when there's nothing else going on in my home network. And Netflix doesn't. So that's a big selling point. They're each at about $12 a month for HD in the case of Netflix. And I'm not sure whether I'll keep them on or not. Torrents are still attractive, of course. But if Netflix does get a bit more quirky product for Australian viewers to enjoy, I think that it may be a winner in this kind of race. But Presto, I saw Soldier, the Kurt Russell movie. I watched that again, and it holds up pretty well. The effects hold up pretty well. Kurt Russell's acting in it is superb. I think it's a nice bit of genre acting and really to be commended. He comes across very well as the person raised as a soldier in the future on a junkyard planet trying to save a bunch of people who have ended up on that planet from the evil, nasty, bad guys. That was a nice revisit. I think that it works well, and I think the human story works as well as the big picture explosions and killings and all that kind of thing. So it's a nice revisit. I also watched Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, with Ben Stiller, whose face is getting really weird. I think there's a little bit too much Botox there or something. But his face is going in a really strange direction. Yes, it was the second last role for Robin Williams, and I don't think neither it nor the last role, which was some kind of silly Christmas movie, do justice to the career of Robin Williams. And yeah, this one is kind of more of the same. I'm not particularly invested in the characters in that franchise, so there wasn't too much for me there. It was kind of like meh. So, nothing fantastic there. Then I tried something on Netflix, and I watched Wanted, the action film with James McAvoy and Angelina Jolie from a few years ago. It's a kind of action flick with Angelina Jolie and James McAvoy in it. Not as good as the comics, I'll be honest with you. I think it's Mark Millar did the comics. I'm not sure, but I could be wrong. But the comics are much better than the movie is. But I tested it to see how the streaming went and how the buffering went from Netflix. And I'm not disappointed in that side of things. So I watched that more as an experiment than anything else. And it was just a way to pass the time. The other thing I saw is a science fiction movie starring Antonio Banderas called Automata, which came out about a year ago. And it's got a little too much Blade Runner in it and a little... There's nothing that brings new to the game, really. It's got a little bit of iRobot. It's got a little bit of Blade Runner. It's, it just doesn't work. It was done on a fairly small budget, and I think they've done fairly well to present what they presented on the small budget. But it's nothing I haven't seen before in a film, which is always disappointing with a science fiction film in particular. But it's got Melanie Griffith in there, because, of course, her and Antonio Banderas are married. And Melanie Griffith's face, and I don't mean to be too unkind to her, has had a terrible amount of work done to it. And there's a kind of female robot in the movie whose face is more expressive than Melanie Griffith's. I think their acting was fine in it, but the things that she has had done to the front of her head really do her an injustice. I think her mother, Tippi Hedren, who has a much more natural look and has lines and age and character in her face, is a lot more watchable, even in her later years, than her daughter Melanie Griffith is. And that's a sad and horrible thing to say, but I think that plastic surgery and other procedures end up being self-defeating at a certain stage of a person's life, and after a certain number of procedures, they really work contrary to their intention. And that's a sad thing to see for anybody. I mean, Melanie Griffith is the same age as me, and I'd rather see her with a recognisably human face than the one, unfortunately, that she wears at the moment. It's one of my bugbears with acting, and I think that, yes, there are unusual and strange pressures on women in the thespic arts, and I don't think that, I don't think it's a good thing. I like people's faces to be people's faces, and well, I'll leave that there. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. Now, two movies I'm doing this time around are retro to the max. We've got 1964's The Time Travelers, directed and written by Ib Melchior, who died recently, very recently. And I thought I wanted to do this because it's a good old-fashioned drive-in movie. It's a good old-fashioned Saturday night with a horror host kind of movie to watch. And it's interesting. It was done on a very small budget, even for the time, about $250,000. And it does a few bits of tricky, which are kind of cool. And there's a nice retro look to it, and there's some interesting stuff. You can see that the people tried hard with this one. So we're going to talk about that. Well, I am. And then after that, we're going back to one I talked about in Paleo Cinema a long time ago, but I wanted to revisit to make it part of the Martian Drive-In podcast canon. And that is the final program, also known as The Last Days of Man on Earth, from 1973, starring John Finch, Jenny Reneker, Sterling Hayden, Harry Andrews, and Derek O'Connor. Now, I like the Michael Moorcock's writing, and I like the Jerry Cornelius story, so I thought I'd do this one. Even though it's not an entirely successful adaptation, it's still a lot of fun, and I remember seeing it many moons ago in a hardtop cinema. But anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the first of those two films, The Time Travelers, totally unimaginative title, but not an unimaginative movie, from 1964.
You are still in your own world, Earth. The year is 2071.
And Dennis Patrick take you into a world beyond belief, where a season's growth can be condensed into seconds. Variable light becomes a seductive, melodic symphony. And the Lumachord, the love machine, gives sensuous stimulation that conditions both men and women to a fuller, richer life of love. This is the world of the force field barrier, the laser pulse beam, the vibratransporter, and the Alpha Centauri starship. In the year 2071, scientific superbrains manufacture almost human robots. Whole armies of androids that fight off tents.
We are the last normal human beings on Earth. There is a creeping death all around us, and we cannot stay.
Where can you go?
To another planetary system.
Sorry about the sound quality on that one. That's the best trailer I could get for The Time Travelers, a 1964 American science fiction movie directed and written by Ib Melchior and starring Preston Foster, Mary Anders, Philip Carey, Steve Franken, and a bunch of the Los Angeles Lakers, which I believe is a basketball team of some kind. The cinematographer for the film was a person who went on to win an Academy Award, which is kind of cool. And that is Vilmos Zsigmond, who won an Oscar, he said, looking this up. Many years later, of course, this is one of his very early gigs in Hollywood. He originally was born in Hungary. But he won for Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He was nominated again as a cinematographer for The Deer Hunter, The River, The Black Dahlia. And he did a whole bunch of different movies, some of the best movies of the last 50 years, in fact. Things like Deliverance, he was the DP on that. Let me have a look here. He was the DP on Real Genius, a movie that I like a lot, The Witches of Eastwick. Heaven's Gate, that Michael Cimino failure. Winter Kills, another movie I like a lot. Sugarland Express, Girl from Petrovka. Cinderella Liberty, he was the one on that. McCabe and Mrs. Miller. So this guy had a long career, and he started out in this quite low-budget and quite simple science fiction movie that Ib Melchior put together. The cast isn't spectacular in this one. Preston Foster is the only interesting person in the... Well, he's not the only interesting person, but he's one of the most interesting people in the cast. He had a minor career as an actor in cinema and on stage from around the 1920s to the 1940s. And one, his biggest claim to fame, from our point of view here in the second decade of the 21st century, is that he wrote Got My Mojo Working, the Muddy Waters song. He wrote the original version of that with his wife. So there's a connection between Muddy Waters, rhythm and blues, and this science fiction movie. So I always like to try to find those little weird connections. But yeah, Preston Foster wrote that. Philip Carey's in it as well. Philip Carey, the thing people remember him for most now, and this is a weird one, and you never know where your career's going to go and where it's going to take you when you're an actor, but the thing he's remembered for most was he was in an episode of the TV series, where is it? All in the Family, where he played a retired football player who was a friend of Archie Bunker's in the series, who turned out to be gay. And it was one of the first times in network television that being homosexual was seen in a positive light. And he played it really well. I've seen the episode, actually found it and watched it a while back. And even though it is 1970s and some of it's a bit naive and some of it may not be politically correct by any means, the fact that a network television comedy show had a male gay character who was seen in a positive light and who was a big butch ex-football player was kind of cool. It was really good to see that, and it's interesting just to follow the arc of civil rights in various ways through the medium of television, and Philip Carey played that role. In real life, he was a straight gentleman, but he played the role, so he, obviously his heart was in the right place. It was he did it very well, and he did it very positively and very charmingly. The movie, getting back to The Time Travelers, though, the movie also has other people in it. Mary Anders, a kind of jobbing starlet almost. John Hoyt, who we know from any number of things, including the very first pilot episode of Star Trek where he played the ship's doctor. He's in there as well. And the thing I remember him for most of all, of course, is playing Flesh Gordon's father in the movie Flesh Gordon. Not Flash Gordon, but Flesh Gordon. He was in there. You got Dennis Patrick in there. Steve Franken, a kind of light comedy actor who started out doing The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis and went on to have a serious career. In fact, he plays one of the Cardinals in the Tom Hanks movie Angels and Demons. Steve Franken died a couple of years ago, but he went on to have a serious career. There are two other people of interest in the movie, and I'll tell you the plot of the movie after I talk about them. The first one is Forrest J. Ackerman's in there in a little cameo as a scientific technician doing a little trick to show the wonderfulness of science in the future. So he's in there. Of course, he as an actor, he made a very good magazine publisher. The other person is the guy playing the mutant in the movie. He's a guy that has no feet and has kind of crab claw hands. He was played by a guy called Peter Strudwick, who was a marathon runner. Even though he had no feet, he just had kind of like knobby bone things on the end of his feet because his mother contracted rubella while she was pregnant with him. He was born in 1930. He went on to be a jogger and a marathon runner in spite of having no feet. And he's quite poignant as a character. I think he's got a certain intensity, even though the character is mute. It's a mute mutant. He comes across quite well in that one, and I like that. Now, the plot of the movie is fairly simple. A bunch of scientists in the 1960s are working on a time window. They have a great big cinema screen, well, small cinema screen size window that they're trying to project into the future. So they want to be able to time travel, to look at things through time. And they're fiddling around with the knobs and getting the settings right, and they don't want to blow all the circuits and all that kind of thing, and accidentally cast the window into the future of 2071, not knowing until Steve Franken's character, Danny, tells them that they've actually opened a portal into the future. You can actually go into the screen and travel into a very rocky, barren, volcanic-looking landscape of the future year 2071. So Danny, of course, being the stupid comic relief guy in the movie, goes and wanders out there, and then somebody else goes to chase him, and someone else goes to chase them, and finally the female technician played by Mary Anders chases a lot of them to go and get them to come back because she's seen something which turns out to be the mutants on the screen. And of course, when everybody has passed through the screen, because they're all too stupid to just stick their head through and shout at the other people, the portal collapses and they're stuck in 2071. This is something I have a problem with, because one of the things I don't like in movies is where characters are required to be really stupid for the plot engine to work. And in this case, they were. They were totally stupid because they all went through the portal, one after the other, just wandering around in an unknown time that looked pretty rough and wild. And then suddenly the portal collapses behind them. That requires an immense amount of stupidity on behalf of the characters. So we'll let that one go, because that's a minor thing, but it's just something that I found annoying when re-watching the film. So they get chased by mutants, all of whom are played by Los Angeles Lakers basketball players, because they needed really tall and really fit guys to run around and run around the kind of landscape outside Barstow in California in weird little tunics carrying spears to chase these scientists in their lab coats up and down little gullies. So they do that, and eventually the scientists take refuge in a cave and find that there's a force field there to keep the mutants out. Then they meet the people from the year 2071, who are the last people on Earth, it's said. And they're the descendants of a bunch of scientists who survived the nuclear war, because this is a 1960s science fiction movie set in the future, and there is always a nuclear war. They show some stock footage of various nuclear explosions to the people and just explain that what they're doing is they're the last people surviving. The whole rest of the world is covered in rampaging mutants, and they're trying to build a spaceship to go to Alpha Centauri because there's nowhere in the solar system that can support human life. Now, there's an argument for that. We know a little bit more now. We know that you could probably terraform Mars, but there's problems with dust and perchlorates, and the moons, you get a problem with dust and, of course, the lack of an atmosphere and all that kind of stuff. But they've decided that what they're going to do is pile everybody into a spaceship and go to Alpha Centauri, because there's a planet there that looks pretty okey-doke. And they can get there in suspended animation because they've invented a whole army of androids that they can use to look after the ship while everybody's in suspended animation and gets to the new planet successfully. The androids, the thing is that this movie does that's kind of interesting is a lot of the super science technology of the future, including the assembly of androids, is actually done with stage magic techniques. There's a teleportation device, which is a pretty easy to figure out, Las Vegas magician kind of contraption. There's a nice shot where one of the androids lays down on a table. They remove its head and replace it with another head, and then it gets back up again. It's obviously a bit of a stage magic with a table with a false bottom, and it's kind of fun for that. And it's, you've got to accept the fact that they couldn't do CGI in those days, and if they could, this one probably couldn't afford it, because the budget on the whole film was only $250,000, which isn't a lot of money to spend when you're telling a time travel tale set in the future with a rocket ship, mutants, a scientific civilization, and all sorts of groovy things. A lot of kind of eye candy there to keep the kids watching the movie on television or in a drive-in cinema occupied. And the movie does pretty well for that. You know that a lot of these things are kind of magician's trickery, but they're a bit of fun. You don't have seen them in science fiction movies before, so you kind of accept the fact that they're going to do that kind of thing. And that's where Fori Ackerman comes in as one of the technicians. There's also a really interesting dynamic among the people in the future, where one of the female technicians of the future takes a shine to Danny, and that just happens to be a girl called Rena, played by Dolores Wells, who 4 years before was a Playboy centerfold. And she instantly tells him that she finds him attractive and wants to spend the night with him. And yeah, he's up for that too, because she's very much attractive and he's the kind of character normally played by Steve Franken. And then they go and spend the evening in a kind of little grotto area along with Phil Carey's character Steve and his girlfriend, the scientist Carol, who are necking in the corner. And Rena plays a Lumicord, which is a kind of light device, which was, if you look into the history of Lumicords, it's quite interesting, and I'm going to go into that in a little bit of detail here. The actual music that's played on the Lumicord is by the composer for the film, Richard LaSalle, who does a pretty good job of it, really. Even though he didn't do large movies, he did a number of other things. He composed music for a lot of television things. He did some of the incidental music for things like Land of the Giants and a whole bunch of 1950s and 1960s westerns and war films and things like that. The device itself was actually an instrument created by a man, Oscar Fischinger, who wanted to do for light what a Hammond organ had done for music. And so he created this device, which is, it's a bit hard to describe, so I'll describe it the way that Wikipedia has it, and that's probably the best way to go about it. The instrument produced imagery by pressing against a rubberized screen so that it would protrude into a narrow beam of colored light. As a visual instrument, the size of the screen was limited by the reach of the performer. Two people were required to operate the Lumigraph, which is what it was called in the original thing. One to manipulate the screen to create imagery, and the second to change the colour of the lights on cue. The device itself was silent, but was performed accompanying various music. So obviously, Melchior and his people had seen the Lumigraph and decided that's just what they needed for their science fiction movie. And it kind of does give a weird wonderfulness to the proceedings, along with this very kind of eerie and moogie soundtrack by Richard LaSalle. The biggest problem Melchior had with the movie was the budgetary limitations, which stopped him from doing a lot of the script that he wanted to do. So the movie, in a sense, isn't the movie that he wanted to make, but it was a movie he could make given the resources that he had. And all of these little bits, the stage magic, the kind of tight costumes on the people from the future, particularly the women, really kind of gave it a futuristic feel, kind of in the same way the creation of the humanoids did with the costumes that it had on the people in that. They're kind of pulp science fiction covers come to life in a lot of ways. And that's nice to see. It's got that kind of retro idea of what the future's like with people wearing high-collared costumes with kind of tights as the bottom part of the costumes, and androids with pointy heads and little speaker grills for mouths and all that kind of stuff. All of those appurtenances of science fiction at the time are sitting in this movie. The mutants, the atomic war, travel to another star system, androids, different sexual mores in the future, which are a necessity in this circumstance because obviously people are going to have to repopulate after they get to Alpha Centauri. And that's, of course, led to a change in the way that relationships work. And that's kind of ambitious stuff to do in this kind of movie. It's not successful from that point of view. And were it done at a later time, it would have had a more salacious angle to some of those changes. But the movie tries, and I admire that. I admire movies that kind of show us things that haven't been in movies before. And there's some things in this one that, even though the mutants in the future and the atomic war thing have been done before as far back as the 1950s, this movie still, it's quite ambitious for what it is. It's got time travel, it's got space travel, it's got atomic wars, it's got mutants, it's got changed social patterns, and there's a lot in there. There's a lot of juice in there. It doesn't come together, of course, because of the limitations of both the time in which it was made and the technologies available to portray certain things, and the money problems that Melchior had making the movie. But it's nonetheless, it's one of those kind of, it's an almost an iconic part of early 1960s science fiction. All those geeky, nerdy kids that watch this sort of stuff at the time have a great fondness for the film, even as we recognise the flaws in it. And there are a few movies like that at the time that we're forgiving of because of that nostalgia. And it's not a kind of uncritical nostalgia because, yeah, the movie does have problems. But again, I come back to that thing where I love movies that are ambitious and that kind of try to do very bold things and don't always succeed, but at least they're trying to, rather than just following the known path and the way a lot of studio films at the time did, and which is one of the reasons why studios ended up dying in the arse for a long time, in that they weren't willing to take chances and weren't willing to put their money into things that maybe won't work but will move the art form forward. And that's one of the reasons why, particularly in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s and 1990s, independent productions started to really be the cutting edge of cinema. And then all of the studios, even though they're making a shit ton of money from the big blockbusters, play catch up in some ways. And the tide lifts all the boats, so the quality of even the mainstream movies these days are somewhat higher than they would be otherwise, because the independent films have led the way. And this is a small independent film that in some small way led the way for science fiction in the future, even though I still think that everybody was dumb for walking through that portal to chase each other, knowing that the portal could collapse at any moment. I think that was very ill-considered and showed extremely poor workplace occupational health and safety. But having said that, I'm going to leave The Time Travelers there. It's a nice little piece of its time, and I do like the fact that women in 2071 are all going to look like 1960s Playboy playmates, because that's a future that I can really believe in. Time for another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to be talking about 1973's The Final Program, starring John Finch, Jenny Reneker, and Sterling Hayden.
The end of the world.
How long have we got?
There are exactly 14 minutes left.
I'm afraid the old place is going up.
Have you heard about Amsterdam?
Yeah, some mistake.
28 square miles of white ash.
Civilization's about to blow itself apart.
Don't look at the money!
Pray that out of this world of anarchy and hysteria, some supreme being will emerge. A new messiah, born of the age of science.
Has that messiah been born yet, I wonder?
What is more important, who will recognize him if he has?
Produce an all-purpose human being, an hermaphrodite, immortal. Can't you feel our bodies merging? We shall be the new messiah.
The twilight of the gods.
Or humanity.
Or both.
The ultimate in science fiction, rated R.
So The Final Program is a 1973 English science fiction movie starring John Finch, Jenny Reneker. It's got Harry Andrews in it, Sterling Hayden, and a whole bunch of other people. It's based on the character of Jerry Cornelius, created by Michael Moorcock, a very fine science fiction writer who has since branched out into other endeavours, but still comes back to his original love of science fiction. He started writing it when he was 15 years old and was very big in the 1960s resurgence of a science fiction magazine called New Worlds, which went in a very experimental kind of direction. And almost single-handedly, that magazine created what was known at the time as New Wave Science Fiction, which has since fallen by the wayside, of course, but has still remained influential in science fiction in the fact that they took a literary approach to science fiction storytelling, which is something that hadn't really been done up to that point. A lot of writers were a part of that. There was Moorcock himself, Norman Spinrad, a bunch of others, but John Brunner, after whom one of the characters in the movie, Miss Brunner, is named. They all took things in a new direction for science fiction. It was a breath of fresh air. It was kind of like the artists took over from the engineers in science fiction, and that the genre has never been the same since, at least as far as the literary form is concerned. But this movie is based on the first of the Jerry Cornelius novels, and there have been any number of iterations of Jerry Cornelius. Published in 1968, it tells the story's a bit hard to tell, but I'll give it a go. In fact, I'm going to fudge things, and I'm going to read it off the back of the DVD. DVD that was released in the UK. There isn't an Australian release, or, as far as I know, an American release yet, though there may well be by this time. It says, "Mankind is in a state of decay, but a group of scientists believe they have found the means to move humanity onto its next level in the creation of an ideal, self-replicating, and thus immortal human being. Jerry Cornelius, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and playboy adventurer, is vital to the project's success. His recently deceased father devised the formula of this final program. However, the formula is captured on a microfilm hidden in the vault in the family mansion and jealously guarded by Jerry's drug-addicted, psychopathic brother, Frank." Dot, 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 it says. And that's a good start for it, too. Frank's played by Derek O'Connor, an actor whose hair never looked good. In this movie, which is his first movie, his hair looks stringy and straight and stringy and not very well kept. And he was actually in Deep Rising, the movie I talked about in the last podcast. And again, his hair is stringy and unkept. The guy doesn't seem to have changed too much of his hairstyle since the 1970s. But he plays a nasty little ratty, snivelling, whining bastard against the sophistication but essential cowardice of the Jerry Cornelius character. And then you bring in other people who are involved in the story, the most prominent of whom is Miss Brunner, played by Jenny Runica, an actor who's still acting and teaching at the moment, which is kind of nice to hear because she's really good in this. She's red-haired, she's got kind of slightly vulpine features, and she is unashamedly bisexual. This is kind of good too because one of the things that Miss Brunner has as a skill is she absorbs other people, absorbs their essence and absorbs them physically. And one of the things Jerry says to her at one stage is, "What do you do with the bones?" So she's important to the project because the creation of this superhuman being requires Miss Brunner's particular skills as part of the process. But overall, the movie doesn't have a lot of logic to it. It does move along briskly. There was a lot of trouble making it, which was one of the problems. In fact, I've got a book here which has a fair bit about the making of this movie. It's kind of a good reference book, if you want a reference book of science fiction up until about the 1970s, and it's called The Cinema of Science Fiction Future Tense by John Brosnan. It's got a foreword by Harry Harrison. Now, this book I had in a trade paperback edition, but the bindings on the trade paperback were woefully bad, and only about 3 weeks ago, when I was travelling around the countryside, I did find a copy of it for $10. It's an ex-library copy, but it's a hardcover, and it's in pretty good shape for a book that was published, he said, looking it up, 1978. So it's in good shape for a 1978 publication. And it's got a lot of information directly from Michael Moorcock about his involvement in making the movie. The movie was directed and written, the script written by Robert Foost, who people remember from being the writer, director, and engine behind the Dr. Fibes movies, The Abominable Dr. Fibes and Dr. Fibes Rides Again. And Fust and Moorcock didn't particularly get on. Fust had his own image of how the movie should be, and the actual author of the novel had a different image. So what Moorcock did was he talked it through with the producers and with Fust and EMI, the company that the production company. and wrote his own script of it, tightening things up, tightening the plot up, making the things a little more comprehensible, and giving the actors in particular a good sense of who the characters were. But in the end product, things didn't turn out that way. One of the problems was that Fuse took on the script and sat down with the producers and the production company and said, yeah, this is great, we're going to use this, and then went off and used his original script, totally and utterly ignoring Moorcock's version of the script, which, yeah, pissed off Moorcock. He had an emotional investment, of course, in the characters and the story and the possibility of sequels as well. The sequels would have been difficult because the stories get more and more meta as the arc of Jerry Cornelius goes on. But nonetheless, Moorcock was very invested in it. He wanted a band with whom he'd worked a lot to do the soundtrack for the movie. That band being Hawkwind, the kind of space rock band from the 1960s and 1970s. In fact, both them and Moorcock appear for one brief moment in the background at the nightclub where Jerry Cornelius, well, the pinball parlor where Jerry Cornelius turns up at one stage. But the music was done, ended up being done by Jerry Mulligan, and it's a more jazzy score, and it kind of gives it a slightly out of time feel. I think the choice of the soundtrack actually works for the film, because I think that with the kind of saxophony jazz soundtrack, it gives the movie, it unhinges the movie from the 1970s and puts it in a kind of more nebulous time, whereas the music of Hawkwind may well have dated the movie ultimately. But I would have liked to have seen Moorcock's script. I think he was a fairly good script writer. In fact, he also did the script for another movie, The Land That Time Forgot, which, again, people didn't really use his script to the fullest, and there were a lot of production problems with the with that movie, which I'm actually going to watch after I finish this podcast. I've decided to go on a two-movie Moorcock binge and watch The Land of Time Forgot after I finish the podcast. But the characters are interesting. Jerry Cornelius in his dandified black Edwardian-style suits, his lank black hair, his sallow complexion, his black painted fingernails, the fact that he seems to live entirely on a diet of whiskey, drugs, and chocolate biscuits is kind of interesting. Miss Brunner, who gets all the best fashions, of course. There are also other people. Harry Andrews plays the major domo of the Cornelius household, which is booby-trapped to hell with kind of super scientific booby traps, visual hallucinations that cause pseudo-epilepsy, poison and hallucinogenic gases, sound weapons, all sorts of stuff like that, which is kind of portrayed very well. And in Fuse's defense, the movie is visually really fascinating. He frames shots really well. The sets are incredibly cool. There's a nightclub where people mud wrestle in white mud while everybody sits around and drinks dehydrated French Bordeaux with water added to it, of course, to rehydrate it. And, it's very much got the otherworld, apocalyptic, end of days kind of feel about it in a lot of ways. Trafalgar Square is piled up with derelict cars. There's a lot of talk, particularly in the scenes where there's one scene where Jerry goes to meet Wrongway Lindbergh, kind of military procurer played by Sterling Hayden, the classic actor from a number of film noir movies. And they have some fun, crazy dialogue together about the state of the world, the fact that Amsterdam has been turned into white ash and other things. And there are all these little bits of dialogue that kind of fill in the gaps of the world that they live in. Now, Sterling Hayden, interesting actor too. He was going to have to talk to the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s. And instead, he basically grabbed his son, hopped on his boat, and went exploring the South Seas for a couple of years. In fact, he wrote a novel about it called Wanderer, which is kind of cool. And if you can get a hold of any of his non-fiction writings, or even his novel, Sterling Hayden's writing is really interesting. And he talks about that time of his life in very poetic and evocative terms, and about his history, about his love life, about all sorts of things. So he's a very interesting kind of guy. Very fond of marijuana, so he would have got on really, really well with 21st century American stand-up comics. But in this one, he's got an enormous chin beard and he's crazy. And he just seems to be, of all the actors in the movie, apart from perhaps John Finch, he's the one that seems to be totally on board with the Gonzo style of the movie. Now, as I said, none of the actors really had a good latch on their characters. Several of them talked to Moorcock about it, particularly George Koulouris, one of the older actors who plays one of the scientists setting up the final program, had real problems with it. Now, Koulouris had a long and illustrious career, which, towards the start of it, he worked with the Mercury Theatre, and in fact, he's in Citizen Kane. And from there, he's gone on to the final program and a couple of other things towards the end of his career, and he really needed to get a latch onto the character, and ended up playing it as a slightly befuddled scientist, mostly because he was slightly befuddled about what his job was supposed to be. But he gets in a few nice little lines in the movie as well. You've got Harry Andrews, of course, one of the great character actors of the middle of the 20th century in England. He was pretty much in every second British film of the 1960s. You got Ronald Lacey in there. He played the Nazi villain in Raiders of the Lost Ark. He was one of the main Nazis in there, the guy with the black suit and the coat hanger in Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's in there as well. Hugh Griffiths, who people remember was the guy who trained the horses for Ben-Hur, he's in this movie. It's one of those movies where they grabbed any character actor they could and just put them in, had a couple of scenes with them. Patrick McGee has a few scenes set in Spain. The film was filmed both in the UK and in Spain. Spain actually doubled for Lapland in some weird way at the start of the film, but I'm not sure how they made that work, but for some reason they did. There's a funeral pyre for Jerry's father at the start of the film where they say they're in Lapland, and basically what they went into was a little chunk of desert in Spain and had everybody wear heavy coats. That's the magic of film, of course. Now, Robert Fust's career petered out a little bit after this. There are a couple of other things he did. He did The Devil's Reign, the movie with William Shatner and Ernest Borgnine, where Ernest Borgnine's face melts. And there was a lot of talk. In fact, there was a BFI talk that Michelle Farber did about this very movie a couple of years ago. You can find it on YouTube. And one of the things he said about Fust, which was probably the most telling thing, was that he was a kind of... he wasn't a genius, but he was trying to be one, and he was an interesting director in spite of that. Like myself, Faber had seen the movie in Australia. He saw it on Australian television late at night when they were showing really weird movies late at night before that horrible and ubiquitous infomercial thing now. Australian commercial TV channels, most of the night, after midnight, basically show infomercials, and which is one of the reasons, of course, that cable streaming and torrent downloads became popular, because if you're an insomniac and you're up late at night, the last thing you want to do is watch somebody touting yet another blender for 3 or 4 hours. But anyway, I saw the movie. Remember how in the past in the podcast I've said that one of the things I did was travel 30, 40, 60 kilometres to see a movie because it was only on at one cinema in Sydney? The final program was one of those films. I travelled from the western, southwestern suburbs of Sydney where I grew up, took a train into the city. I probably took a bus to the train station, took a train into the city, then took a bus out to, I believe it was either Bondi Junction or Double Bay. You've got to remember, this was in the 1970s, it's a long time ago now. But I took it out to the eastern suburbs of Sydney, where I was very much a duck out of water, being a surly, nasty little underprivileged guy, to watch the movie. And I enjoyed it too. Now, a lot of people have a problem with this film from a couple of viewpoints, one of which is it doesn't stick too closely to the original Moorcock. And the other is that the ending is very, very different. The ending's a very 1960s ending in the novel. It's got that kind of craziness and nihilism and apocalyptic feel about it, whereas the ending that Fust chose for this movie is very, very different, and the ultimate human being is a very different kind of creature than the one posited in the novel. But I can forgive it right up to that point. I think that Fust's choice at the end of the movie was the easy choice to make, and was kind of punchline-y rather than being a fitting ending in a sense. But right up to that point, I really liked the style of it. There's some really witty dialogue in the film that doesn't particularly draw attention to it. So if you've got to listen carefully to the funniness of the dialogue and the character bits that are in the dialogue, particularly Jerry's dialogue. And John Finch, interesting actor too. He, of course, played Macbeth in the Polanski Macbeth in the 1970s with Francesca Annis playing Lady Macbeth, and was good in that too. His career suffered in later years because he was diabetic and had a lot of health issues related to that. In fact, it was on a movie set where he was diagnosed with diabetes, and so his health kind of went west, and the roles particularly weren't there. And I'm not particularly sure that he wanted to be a movie star. I think he was more interested in the acting part of it than the celebrity part of it. But in spite of the director and the script not giving him too much to hang on to, as far as the character was concerned, he does a really good job of it too. This particular iteration of Jerry Cornelius, and as I said, he does change throughout the novels, and there's been comic adaptations with him as a character in it. He's twice in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comics as a kind of minor character. And that's one of the things that Moorcock wanted to do with the character. He wanted to make him a kind of all-purpose 20th century protagonist for a lot of things. And he appears in a number of Moorcock's novels in various iterations. There are a lot of characters in Moorcock's novels that have names very similar to Jerry Cornelius, and they're all different aspects of the same person in the multiverse. In fact, Moorcock did a graphic novel called Multiverse, which portrays this. And so John Finch's Jerry Cornelius kind of sits comfortably in there. I think it's an honourable attempt at a character that, if you try to grab onto it, it disappears like smoke between your fingers. It's a bit hard to get a tab on exactly who Jerry Cornelius is. Sometimes he's male, sometimes he's an androgyne, sometimes he's female, sometimes he's old, sometimes he's young, sometimes he's a child, sometimes he's rich and famous, sometimes he's poor and snivelling. He could be anything at all, but they're all in some weird alchemical way the same character. In fact, just thinking about it now, probably the best way to portray Jerry Cornelius on the screen would be to make him into a character in an animated TV series. I think that would work really well. Animation tends to be the cutting edge in some ways of transgressive storytelling in television, particularly now that there's cable and all those kind of limitations of network television have been lifted. I think it could really work in that kind of format, but whether that would ever occur or not is another matter. But just to summarise everything, it's a very 1970s kind of movie. It's one you have to pay attention to as well. To get the best out of this film, you've really got to pay attention to the dialogue and soak in the beautifully constructed visuals of it. And that was one of Fuse's real strengths. He started out doing work as a production designer on the Avengers TV series, the old one with Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg in that one. So he had that kind of weird gonzo design sense that was right for that television series, which of course he brought through as well to the Dr. Fibes movies and other things. And he was very much a man of that time. He really did kind of surf the zeitgeist of the 1960s and 1970s Carnaby Street kind of thing. And there's a lot to the film that's very, very cool. I like the iconography of the character as a playboy Nobel Prize-winning scientist. I like the fact that his weapon of choice is a translucent or transparent needle gun, which is very cool kind of weapon. I'm not sure how effective it is to shoot people with very thin needles as a way of bringing them down, unless, of course, you've got poison on them, which is a possibility. But the needle guns are a very cute conceit, which is from the novel as well. And I'm sure that there's some kind of maker out there who has, at some stage, made a Jerry Cornelius-style needle gun, because they do have a great look to them. And they are that kind of very pop art, op art weapon. Just giving the guy a gun wouldn't have been enough. Having a needle gun which shoots little needles into people and into furniture is a much cooler way to go. And they do retain a lot of the tropes that Moorcock put into the character. There's a lot of, there's a fascination with military weaponry, for instance, and one of the things Jerry does in this movie, though you never do see it, is buys a Phantom jet, a military jet with drop tanks and all sorts of other bits and pieces. And that iconography of weapons of military mass destruction is a very Michael Moorcock, Jerry Cornelius thing. And the other thing you've got to remember too is that this movie was made, and the novel was in a time when the biggest concern, well, the two biggest concerns that people had were, of course, nuclear war, and in the Western world, Vietnam. So that kind of feeling of the breaking down of systems and the atrocities committed by governments is very strong in this movie in various parts as well. So, and of course, an interest in Indian mysticism is part of it too. They talk a lot about the Kali Yuga, the final times, and things like that. And yeah, it's just a mishmash of various pop cultural tropes in a very interesting way. A failed attempt in some ways, but quite an interesting movie in spite of that. And I like it a lot. I'm glad I got a copy of it too. By the way, the Patreon campaign paid for my copy of the final program, so I am feeding the Patreon money back into the podcast in some ways. And I do really have a great fondness for the character of Jerry Cornelius, whom I see in 2015 as being a tattooed hipster bearded barista somewhere in some part of the world, doing interesting and wild things in the background while basically decanting lattes. But anyway, that's about it for that one. I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, we are going to do the credits, of course, in the style of the credits of a movie credit. The only credit I've got to add, which I haven't added yet, is the one for Mark Leeper. And Mark has chosen the credit as second unit director. He also suggested a movie for the podcast, which is his right indeed, as a Patreon subscriber of the podcast. And so either next time around or the time after that, I'm going to be doing the movie he recommended, which is Sleep Dealer, which is looks to be an interesting movie. It's one of those ones that's on my list, but I haven't seen yet. So I'm looking forward to dealing with Sleep Dealer from 2008, which is a Mexican movie from what I can see here, and looks to be quite interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing this one because, of course, even though I cover the waterfront when it comes to genre works, there are things that slip between the cracks, and having them pointed out to me and having people direct me to the stuff that I've missed is a cool and groovy part of what I'm doing here. So anyway, until the next time we talk, please look after yourselves, watch good movies, keep watching the skies. If you want to support the Patreon campaign, I've still got the goodie bag of stuff that I'm going to draw out a winner for in April. There are a few DVDs in there. There is Blu-ray. There's a whole bunch of movie-related cool shit in the box, and somebody has to win it. So if you support the Patreon campaign at patreon.com/paleocinema, you're in to win. So anyway, look after yourselves, and I'll talk to you again very soon. Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Armin, the key grip, Jan, the dialect coach, Morris, the musical director, Gary, the prop master, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire, the script doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people, and if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, the Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.